ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
We are surrounded by incredible design, tools, objects, little inventions, each one solving a problem, each one refined over time. They're so good at what they do, we don't even think about them anymore. But every one of them has a story worth telling. Welcome to Extraordinary Everyday. I'm Anthony Burke. Think back to your most treasured possession as a child. Maybe it was an action figure, a transformer, or a miniature Han Solo or Chewbacca. But while dolls date back to ancient times, action figures are a relatively new product. So, when did action figures first hit toy shops, and how has their design changed over time? Professor Jason Bainbridge is Dean of Curriculum and Quality at the University of Southern Queensland. His research focuses on popular culture, and he's written extensively about action figures. Not only that, he's a collector himself. Jason, great to talk to you.
Fantastic to be here, Anthony.
So, how did you get into action figures?
Well, I think it was one of those things, being a child of the 70s and Star Wars just being everywhere, it seemed to be every year, every moment, there'd be some new action figures coming out, whether it was based on a film or based on a TV series or a cartoon or comic. So I think children of that era particularly, it's just such a natural thing to be interested in action figures. We were surrounded by them.
So were action figures like aimed specifically at the boys? I mean, as an antithesis to the girls with their dolls?
Very much so. So the action figure came into existence really when you've got two leading toy companies in America, Hasbro and Mattel. And Mattel are having enormous success with their Barbie line of toys, which of course is geared towards girls. However, the Hasbro executives note that boys seem to be playing with the Ken dolls. And that gives them this idea that perhaps there is a market in the doll line for boys, but obviously trying to convince parents, particularly that dolls are for boys, is going to be a step too far. So they come up with the idea of the action figure, which focuses very much on that maneuverability, posability. So we see that in 64 with the original 12-inch G.I. Joe, and he's marketed as America's movable fighting man. So as far from Barbie as you can get.
G.I. Joe, G.I. Joe, fighting man from head to toe, on the land, on the sea, in the air.
Terrific equipment to have a battle with. When you get G.I. Joe and the authentic G.I. Joe equipment, you'll have the greatest realism, the greatest fun you ever had in playing soldier.
So 64, that was the first action figure then, is that right?
Yes. So it's Don Levine, who was the director of marketing at Hasbro at the time. He comes up with this idea of how are we going to sell dolls to boys? Let's call them action figures. Let's focus on that action element. Let's focus on the fact that it's a human figure and all of these things you can simulate with that, you know, replicating the various strands of the military. That was the idea behind G.I. Joe.
And now I'm in my mind too. I've got Hasbro and Mattel kind of, you know, duking it out. if you like, for dominance in this market. Were there any other players in the game at this stage?
Hasbro opened up the market. Once Hasbro had done that, we started to see some others come in, particularly Mego, which was a toy company in the 70s, which came in with a number of superhero figures. So once Hasbro were very successful launching G.I. Joe, then the market really exploded. Then suddenly everyone was on board trying to create their own action figures.
It sounds like a rush. Everyone was getting on board.
Very much so. And Mego sort of then took the crown as the lead action figure, and they changed up the size of the action figure. They were the first one to move away from what had then been a 12-inch or a 30-centimetre doll, which was what G.I. Joe was, action figure, but it kind of on those doll dimensions. Mego shrunk that down to being around a 7-inch figure, which meant that they could provide more scaled accessories. So you could make Batman, but you could make the Batmobile as well. You could make the Batcave. You could start to build that environment for the action figure to be in.
A whole universe.
Exactly.
Part of this was you didn't just buy one action figure. You had to buy at least two because they had to kind of fight with each other.
Exactly.
So you had to be a collector, right?
Yes. So that idea of collecting is built in early With G.I. Joe, it's based on that razor blade model that Barbie made so popular. So you'd buy a couple of dolls and then you'd buy lots of outfits, lots of accessories that would go with them. So it's similar to having the razor and then buying the blades for the razor. That's where that kind of idea comes from. With the smaller scale, though, suddenly they're cheaper, which means that kids can buy more and you start to move into this very much that collecting mentality that we see carried through with things like Pokemon to the present day, where there's this idea that you can suddenly assemble a collection of these things.
Wow. So what materials were these early figures made from?
Most of them were plastics. They all had that kind of plastic base, similar to what we saw with Barbie. Before that, the closest analogy would be those sort of wooden design dolls that artists would use for human anatomy. That's another inspiration for the action figure. But predominantly since G.I. Joe, it's always been plastic, and occasionally you get metal figures coming through there as well, but largely plastic.
So you mentioned G.I. Joe a couple of times now. How did the Vietnam War impact that idea? I mean, you said it was like to tie it to the military and to tie it to, of course, the action. But I mean, was there a kind of an explicit connection to Vietnam and that sort of real history?
And not an explicit connection, but enough of a connection to make it a problem. So obviously you're promoting G.I. Joe as the fighting man. You've got all of these debates happening in America over whether, you know, they should be in Vietnam, what's the role of the military, et cetera, et cetera. So G.I. Joe, rather reluctantly, I think, gets caught up in that narrative, and suddenly the toy makers are scrambling as the sales start to drop to find other things for G.I. Joe to do. So you start to see G.I. Joe becoming more of an adventurer, going on a safari, having a bit of jungle action, space action, all these sorts of things as he starts to move further and further away from those military roots because of the problematic connection at the time with the Vietnam War. Yeah.
So was G.I. Joe ever wearing a tie-dye t-shirt and driving around a combi van?
No, he left that to Ken. That was it.
Okay.
Star Wars. You and your children loved it. Now the Earthlings at Kenner have asked my associate and me to present the Star Wars collection. Truly remarkable toys and games for your children.
The next big thing that comes along, I presume, would be Star Wars.
Absolutely. So we talked
game
about...
Game changer, right?
Huge, huge game changer. You had that idea in Japan of a smaller scale, but it's Star Wars that really makes it the industry standard. So that comes about because of two things, basically. Similar to the Japanese idea with Micro Man, it means that you can create these scaled environments. So you can make the X-Wings, you can make the TIE Fighters, you can make Dagobah, Tatooine, all of these sort of play sets and vehicles that I'm sure people can remember from their youth, that suddenly you can have all of those environments in scale to the figures. But again, it was a real world crisis that really drove the move to the 3 3/4 scale, and that was the oil crisis in 73.
Really?
Absolutely. So petroleum is the base for plastics. The cost of manufacture was going through the roof. Kenner realised that they could do something on a much cheaper scale that would also be able to enable them to create all these vehicles, etc., for Star Wars. They also went into Star Wars thinking it may not be that successful. At the time, the idea of toys connected to movies hadn't done particularly well outside of Planet of the Apes. There really hadn't been many toy lines that were connected to a movie because a movie, of course, had its run at the cinema and ended, whereas a TV show was week to week. So, you know, they were more likely to invest in a Starsky and Hutch series of action figures because that's on weekly, whereas the movies would come and go. So at Kenner, there wasn't this great vision that Star Wars was going to be that successful. And in fact, they were caught out by how successful it was.
Recently, a new Masters of the Universe film is hitting the cinemas. And so how did that franchise impact the action figure market of the 1980s? Another big franchise.
Yeah, great, great question. So that's really when we start to see that idea of what an action in action figures changed. So until that point, action was really posability, maneuverability. So the Star Wars figures had basic 5 points of action. You could move their arms, you could move their legs, and you could turn their head. And occasionally a lightsaber would pop out or R2-D2 would make a clicking noise, that kind of thing. But the action was all about movability. With Masters of the Universe, now each of the action figures in the line had their own unique action. So He-Man had a twisting waist and could punch. Cobra Khan could spray water. Mechaneck had a neck that popped up like a telescope. All these sorts of things. Each figure has a unique action. So the action and action figure starts to take on that different meaning. And that kicks off in 82 with the launch of Masters. And again, change in scales, that goes up to 5.5 or about 14 centimetres, so slightly larger than Star Wars, more muscular physique, bigger than the Star Wars figure, and as I said, each figure with their own unique action. So another reason to collect them all.
Is this where we're starting to see action figures not so much as playthings, but as collectibles, as in the sense of like refined collections that will be, that will, you know, we'll trade these things, we'll make money from these things. We can think of them almost as investments.
Absolutely. So we see that sort of obviously generationally. So we're talking about toys that launched in 64 and 77 and 82. So we've got those generations of consumers coming through that have grown up with the line, that now have disposable income perhaps to go back and buy some of those pieces that were significant for them. We also see in about 94, quite a bit later, targeting of adult consumers for action figures. So we see a change in the market again, where we have more high-end products based on properties that are clearly not for children, like Nightmare on Elm Street, Friday the 13th. These sorts of things start to get action figures in the 90s. So you have both a generational change, which brings in the adult consumer, and you have increasingly a targeting of adult consumers by the toy industry.
The Transformers, more than meets the eye. Autobots wage their battle to destroy the evil forces of the Decepticons. The Transformers, more than meets the eye.
So last movie franchise I'm going to mention here, Transformers.
Yeah, so Transformers, I always think, are the ultimate the ultimate action figures, because you go from the action features with Masters of the Universe to an action where the action figure turns into a completely different toy. So you have an action figure that becomes a plane.
More than meets the eye, I think.
That's exactly right. Well done.
I was there.
Yeah. That's
the, like, weren't we all?
So I think that's the interesting thing with Transformers, is that the action feature is, it becomes something else entirely. And that was such a novelty when that came on the market in 84. So, I mean, that's how long that franchise has been around. Again, it was pulling together various Japanese toys into one consolidated line, giving it very much a hero-villain narrative and going from there. And it's never really been out of production. It's always been a Transformers line pretty much running since 84.
Jason, it's been absolutely delightful talking to you. I love this story you're telling, and I'm following it with you, absolutely. I was there through all of that stuff that you've just been talking about, and I know it well. And it's such a great history that, as you say, maps back onto culture so directly. So what a fascinating thing to study, and what a delightful thing to be thinking about. Thanks for this time this afternoon.
Thanks so much. It's been great.
Professor Jason Bainbridge, Dean of Curriculum and Quality at the University of Southern Queensland. To find more episodes, visit ABC Listen and follow the show. Search Anthony Burks by Design.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.